We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Each and every day, we're exposed to statistics. Bombarded, actually, might be a better word than exposed. They're used by lots of folks, including candidates, public officials, business and industry, other special interest groups, and, of course, the media. There are polls, surveys, and statistical analyses. There are claims made on products at the grocery store. How good are these numbers, and how good are we at spotting bad numbers? Our guest today is Joel Best. He's professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Delaware. Joel Best is the author of many books, including three books on statistics for a general audience. They are Damned Lies and Statistics, More Damned Lies and Statistics, and most recently, Stat Spotting, a field guide to identifying dubious data. All three of Joel Best's books on statistics for general readers are published by the University of California Press. Joel Best, good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. So how big a problem are bad statistics?
Well,
you've done three books.
I'm tempted to give you a number. I think it's a real problem. As you suggested earlier, we are confronted with numbers, you know, pretty much day in and day out. I don't think it's possible to pick up the morning newspaper or listen to a broadcast without hearing some sorts of figures. And a lot of times the people who offer these numbers are using them to persuade us, to convince us, sometimes to buy something, more often I think to agree with them. A lot of times people are trying to say, this is a big problem. How big? Well, it's this big. And I think that it's very easy to get confused by these numbers. Some of them are pretty good, and some of them aren't so great. And I wrote this book because I wanted to try and help people think critically about the numbers they encounter.
Yeah. In this latest book on statistics, The Field Guide, you begin with this statement, "The billion is the new million."
Yes, and I think that after the last 6 months, we'd have to say that the trillion is the new billion.
I was going to say, it seems that trillion will soon be the new billion if it's not already. And these are really big numbers. And how does that bigness affect us?
Well, I think it's very easy to get confused. It's very easy to start saying a million, a billion, what's the difference? They're a big number. And it's sort of as though we imagine that all large numbers are equal. And that's really a mistake. You have to remember, a trillion is a million millions, okay? And it's a lot more. And I think that what tends to happen is that we can slide from million to trillion very, very easily. Some months ago, there was a tremendous outrage about the fact that there were some CEOs of companies who'd come away with bonuses in the tens of millions, and this was used to account for trillion-dollar problems that we're having. Now, without justifying the tens of millions of dollars going to executives who managed companies into oblivion, it's important to realize that that salary is a drop in the bucket of the larger economic problems that we're talking about. And I think that because we tend to equate all words that sound like illion, that rhyme with illion, into one big number, it's very easy to get confused.
Yeah. Professor Best, are you still there?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I heard a little blip, and I was concerned maybe that we had lost you. Let's talk a little bit about numbers and their importance and why it is we like them so much.
Well, I think the answer to that is that in third grade we had a unit in social studies where we learned to distinguish between facts and opinions. And we were told that facts were really, really true, and opinions were things that people might believe, but you couldn't prove them to be true. And in third grade, when you're having that unit, the example of a fact is oftentimes something like there are 50 states in the United States. And you start getting the notion in your head that a number is a fact. You presume that somebody has gone out and counted something, that the number is accurate and correct and meaningful. And the point that I keep trying to make is that it's that someone did the counting. Numbers don't exist in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had to decide what to count, how to go about counting. They had a reason for counting that thing. They decide which numbers to talk about and which to ignore. And it's all of those decisions by people that we need to be paying attention to.
And then those numbers get put into a particular context.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we hearken back to third grade and say, well, here, someone just gave me a number. It must be a little nugget of truth. And when we make that assumption, we ignore all of those activities that went into producing that number, all of the decisions that were made to select that number for your consumption.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Joel Best, our guest here on the program this afternoon. He is professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Delaware. We're talking with him this afternoon about statistics. His latest book for general readers on statistics is a field guide, Stat Spotting, a field guide to identifying dubious data. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with us. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes. One of the complaints that I often have with the way polls are used, besides all the common problems with how questions are asked and phrased and so forth, is when people cite poll results of the general populace as if they are actual indications of truth, such as, say, 97% of people responding to this poll felt that, I don't know, pick your thing, gas prices are too high or something, and therefore it must be that gas prices are too high.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, using something that people are trying to convince you of, that the general populace maybe has no actual way of knowing, and that those are used in public policy debates. And since, like you say, if it's a number, it must be some nugget of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go out and conduct a poll that they're and you then use those numbers in public policy debates without really thinking about, hey, is there any reason that this percent of the population has any way of knowing anything about that?
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a number, it must be, you know, if it's a majority of the population, then that must mean something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there. I think the interesting one of the interesting features of that is how readily we now assume that polls are meaningful. There was a very interesting book published a couple of years ago by a historian named Sarah Igo, and she talked about the real difficulty that organizations like the Gallup poll had in the 1930s and 1940s, getting people to accept opinion polls. There was, a lot of people discounted them. They didn't know how to think about them. Their attitude was, well, nobody asked me. You know, why should I listen to this? And now, it's quite the opposite. And as you suggest, there is an assumption that polling numbers are really meaningful indicators of lots of different things, and sometimes they really, if you think about it, can't serve that purpose at all. I think that one of the reasons that we have more statistics is we have become not only much more efficient at manipulating numbers thanks to computers and so on, but we've become a little bit more sophisticated about thinking about them. And the average person knows a little bit about polls, is used to seeing polls and thinking in those terms. And so, you know, the news media give us an awful lot of quantitative information, which they didn't used to do, 20, 30 years ago.
So, listener, want to follow up?
No, thank you very much.
Okay, you're very welcome. And next we go to a listener in Champaign waiting on line 3. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I work with numbers every day, and I have a Dilbert cartoon on my board. And it starts out, he says, I didn't have any accurate numbers, so I just made this one up. And he writes it down, and he says, studies have shown that accurate numbers aren't any more useful than ones you make up. Someone asked him, how many studies showed that? He says, 87. And that pretty well covers it, I think. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that, actually, that's an uncomfortable cartoon in some ways. I like Scott Adams a lot, but I'm not really sympathetic with that view, because I think there are two errors of thought that we make, and one error is the error to credulously assume that a number must be true, which is what I was just talking about a minute ago. But the other error is to assume that the numbers are all bad. They don't mean anything. They're all made up. You can't trust them, and so on and so forth. And I think that kind of cynicism is not really helpful either, because we live in a big, complicated world, and we cannot hope as individuals to accurately experience and understand everything that's going on around us. And we really need numbers to help us make sense of what's happening. So the idea, I think, is not to shed numbers. I'm all for being skeptical about numbers, but I'm concerned about being too cynical about them.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Joel Best, author of, most recently, Stat Spotting, a Field Guide to Identifying Dubious Data. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments about numbers, 333-9455, our telephone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There was a good article in the New York Times yesterday, I thought, that I wanted to share with you, Joel Best, and our listeners this afternoon, because the news media comes in quite often, quite fairly, for some criticism on reporting numbers. And this actually was a piece written by a medical doctor about how do we know what's a pandemic and what's not a pandemic. And I think this is very interesting. In Stat Spotting, you do talk about avian flu, and now we are concerned about swine flu. But this was a very good article, long and fairly in-depth. This fellow, Lawrence Altman, says, dictionaries and medical journals offer us little guidance in defining pandemic. He says there can be many other factors besides what the word implies, the rapid spread of an infectious disease. There can be many other factors, he writes, including the numbers and percentages of people falling ill and dying, a population's vulnerability to the disease based on previous rates of infection, and the quality of healthcare facilities and disease monitoring systems. I thought this was very thoughtful and very informative. Have you seen other things in the media recently where you'd say, boy, they're doing a pretty good job on this?
Oh yeah, I think that you can get lots of good information in media reporting where people will talk about the problems with let's say, the unemployment rate the crime rate, or we've become quite sophisticated in criticizing the census. The census has gotten better and better and better, but we're much wiser about the ways in which it's deficient. And I think that you do get good, thoughtful analyses. At the same time, I think that in everyday life, when people talk about pandemic, the assumption is that that's somehow much worse than an epidemic, and it isn't necessarily. It's really a measure of, as I understand it, it's a measure of the geographic dispersion of the disease, and it doesn't really say anything about how deadly it is so on. So that on the one hand, there's lots and lots of good critical information out there to help us interpret the numbers that we hear. On the other hand, we hear a lot of numbers that are often presented without context and without a lot of thought. And I think that's where we need to be paying attention.
Yeah. Well, when we read a news report or listen to it on the radio or watch it on television or find it on the internet, their reports are often short on the details. Who created a statistic, how it was created, and why it was created. And those are the three key questions we should be asking. So if we're interested in a particular story, where do we go to find out the answers to those questions?
Well, I think that's the issue. And there are, thanks to the internet and so on, it's much, much easier to access information than it used to be. Every Wednesday, you can pick up your newspaper, and there's an excellent chance that you'll see stories saying that this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association or this week in the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers report that, broccoli will kill you or broccoli will keep you alive forever, whatever. And the reason that you get those stories on Wednesday is that that's when the new issue of the journal comes out, and the Journal of the American Medical Association sends out press releases to the media. The New England Journal of Medicine doesn't send out press releases, but they do release advanced copies of the issues. And these are mined by folks, and most of the articles in those journals are of no interest to anybody who isn't either a physician or actually sick with whatever ailment is being discussed in that particular article. But there are these lifestyle articles that have become very newsworthy. It started with smoking, and then it's gone on to secondhand smoke and cholesterol, is wine good for you or bad for you? Is chocolate good for you and bad for you? And on and on and on. And typically, what you get is some little sentence or two that may say, a study showed that broccoli, was dangerous or not dangerous for this particular disease. It may have some kind of number. It may say people who ate broccoli were 26% more or less likely to get sick or something like that. And that's not very much information. And it's not very much information in two senses. One is that you'd really like to know more about the study. You'd like to know more about what what all is going on in the study, and you can oftentimes get on the internet and get that information. The second reason it's not good information is that numbers like that are oftentimes pretty puny. It isn't clear that being 26% more likely to get sick is a big deal. If this is a very, very rare disease, say it affects 4 people in 10,000 or something like that, then a 25% increase is 5 people in 10,000. We're not talking about a real practical difference that has large consequences in the population as a whole. And typically, the media reports don't do a good job of explaining that. And in fact, the journal doesn't do a good job of explaining that, because the journal is issuing that press release in hopes that the media will cover this and get the journal's name in the newspaper.
Yeah. And to what extent does the competition for our attention lead sources of statistics to build some drama into the numbers?
Oh, well, yeah, obviously. That's absolutely essential. We are surrounded by folks who are trying to convince us that whatever problem they're concerned about is a really big problem that we ought to be concerned with. And some of them are a lot more media savvy than others, and they package their claims more efficiently. And the people that do a better job of packaging their claims are more likely to arouse our concern. And oftentimes our concern, the things that we get caught up in, you know, really don't reflect the dangers of the world particularly well. You think about topics that will attract a lot of attention, say teen suicide. Now, you know, obviously teen suicide is very sad, and when it happens you think, oh my goodness, that's tragic, a life cut short. You know, most of us didn't have that much fun as teenagers, and you know, if you could talk to the kid, you'd say, you know, hang on, it'll get better. And you know, it's certainly a human tragedy. It's also something that's happening to, I don't know, maybe 1,500 people a year, something like that. It's not an especially widespread problem. If you compare that to something like deaths from heart disease, there's no comparison at all. Heart disease is killing more than 500,000 people a year. It's a major cause of death.
Mm. One of the ways that the competition for our attention can lead to dubious data or not quite the right context for a problem, let's say teen suicide, but I want to move on to an example that you offer in the book, naming the problem. You offer an example of are the hungry really hungry? And I think this is a really fascinating example, because when you use the word hungry, it really gets at us, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It grabs us emotionally, mm-hmm. like teen suicide.
Mm-hmm. And what you'll see is oftentimes a news report that will say X million Americans go to bed hungry each night. And that actually, strangely enough, the government does not measure hunger. The government measures mm-hmm. something called food insecurity. And they survey people. I think this is the Department of Agriculture that does this. And they ask them, how often is it the case that you don't know where your next meal is coming from, basically? That doesn't mean that you missed a meal. It just means that there's nothing in the cupboard right now. You're nervous. There could be a problem, and that's the concept of food insecurity. It's hard to define. It's sort of awkward. It trips off the tongue in a clumsy way, and it's much easier to translate that into going to bed hungry at night. But in making that translation, we're really not describing something that's happening. And I think that that's something we want to be very careful with. Now, some hunger activists will argue that, you know, the term hungry is a desirable term to use precisely because it does bother people. It is upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
It attracts attention to the problem. It doesn't... I think there's something lost when we accept a level of inaccuracy in order to try and frighten folks. And I think that that's done with all kinds of causes, some of them less noble than hunger advocacy.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I find interesting in this vignette that you've included in Stat Spotting is that food security, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is defined as, this is food security, as having consistent access to enough food for active, healthy lives.
Uh-huh.
And here we are in a debate in this country at the moment over what we're eating, the quality of our food,
mm-hmm.
and are we eating too much food?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here food security involves food for active, healthy lives,
mm-hmm.
which is not junk food.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. so maybe food security in that sense could help us to a better policy debate over obesity.
Well, I think that you could, you know, if you could measure something like eating well, you know, the quality of the diet or something, that might produce an interesting statistic. I think that when the government does food security, though, they would say, are you getting enough calories? They aren't actually going to go through and evaluate whether the proportion of potato chips is too high. You know, once again, you know, it's often the case that you can say, you know, what we'd really like to know about, what we'd really like to measure is this thing over here, but it would be very difficult to measure that, and it's relatively inexpensive and convenient to measure something else, and we'll measure that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes there are advantages to doing that. I mean, everyone, the unemployment rate does not count everybody who doesn't have a job. It doesn't count folks who, for example, are only working part time. It doesn't count folks who have given up and aren't trying to find a job anymore, and so on and so forth. But there may be some advantage to keeping the unemployment rate just because the government's been measuring it the same way for decades. And when it goes up or down, we have a sense of what it means, even though it isn't accurately describing the full nature of unemployment.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Joel Best is our guest this afternoon. He's professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Delaware. He's also the author of many books, including Damned Lies and Statistics, More Damned Lies and Statistics, and most recently, Stat Spotting, a field guide to identifying dubious data. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Have you spotted some questionable numbers recently? Tell us about it. And we invite your questions as well for Joel Best. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. In this book, at the outset of it, you offer readers some statistical benchmarks, and this information is really helpful in getting us to be more critical consumers of statistics. You want to take us through one or two of them?
Sure. I think that there, if you just keep a couple of numbers in mind, it really helps you keep things in perspective. For example, there are a little over 300 million people in the United States. I think that it's really useful to keep that number in mind whenever you're thinking about problems, how common are problems in the United States. Another one that I really like is each year in the United States, there are about 4 million children born. And that's actually a tremendously useful statistic because you know that about half of them are boys and half of them are girls. And if you say to yourself, well, how many, you know, 10-year-old girls are there in the United States? You know the answer is going to be right around 2 million and so on and so forth. And I think that when we hear numbers, I don't want to harp on teen and suicide, but if we say that there are, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000 teenage suicides a year, a thing to do is to think about, well, how many teenagers are there? And there are going to be, you know, four times however many years there are in the teens, eight, say, something like that. There are 32 million kids, okay? And so you can sort of juxtapose that 1,500, 1,600 with 32 million young people, and it gives you a sense of the scale of the problem. And I think that understanding how many people are born each year, roughly how many people die each year, and so on, can really help you keep a lot of things in perspective.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi there. I'm on a mobile, so I'll just leave a question and then, or actually a comment and a question, then hang up. First of all, when I'm on the faculty on campus here, and when I tell my students in their age group that their third most likely cause of death is suicide, they sort of freak out, and then I tell them that that absolute number, 1,500 or 1,600, it gets absolutely lost compared to, say, the number of heart attacks in my age group. I'm in my 50s, and they don't, at that point, they start to sort of grasp the numbers versus percentage thing. But what I'd like the caller to it, or the guest to address, is industries that make a heck of a lot of money on shading and playing games with statistics. The one that I'm most familiar with is the food industry, which will take sort of a doubtful study somewhere and turn it into a billion-dollar profit margin for a product they couldn't sell otherwise. If you have any experience with that, I'd like to hear about it. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I want to start with the first thing that he said, because I think that's really a good point. You know, you will often hear that X is the leading or the number two or the number three cause of death among young people, and it's very important to realize that basically young people don't die. It's very, very uncommon, and they don't have for the most part fatal diseases. And as you age, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond, you know, we're all aware that natural causes, heart disease, stroke, cancer, are going to account for lots and lots and lots of deaths. The number of suicides by old people is actually much higher than the number of suicides by young folks, but because other natural causes come into play, suicide isn't anything close to the third leading cause of death among old folks. And I think that trying to understand these things and to realize that a number that sounds meaningful, you know, HIV/AIDS is the number X cause of death to men in their 20s, it's not wrong, but it creates an implication that you may want to think about critically. Now, regarding the other question, I don't think that you know, I have a specific example, but of course, you know, I can remember the oat bran craze and so on and so forth, and it is quite true that you'll get sometimes a single study, oftentimes in the American Medical Association or the New England Journal of Medicine, and this gets a lot of press coverage, and it can lead to food fads, or it can lead to other kinds of health food fads of different kinds, and that's absolutely a problem.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Joel Best. Listeners, if you'd like to talk with us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was in the cereal aisle yesterday, and I noticed on one particular brand of cereal, same cereal, three different packages, same size. One was sort of a kind of a plain vanilla box. The next one said, and I didn't pick it up and read closely, but it said lower your cholesterol 4 to 6%. Then the next box, same cereal, said lower 10% in 30 days. I thought, now... Are they changing packaging, or do you really need to look at the fine print? Yes to that question, but...
I don't know. I mean, it's possible that they've discovered that they can sell this cereal to different target audiences, and they could produce the same product with multiple packages.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah. I want to talk about one of the vignettes that you included in Stat Spotting, which I got a kick out of, because I've looked at these numbers and thought to myself, what's wrong with this? This is an example that you call losing track of lost productivity.
Oh, yeah.
This is really fun, because we've all seen these reports, right?
Uh-huh.
Wasting time at work, lost hours of productivity, cost in billions of dollars, $544 billion dollars. Let's see here. Email spam, $20 billion. And I love this one. March Madness, $4 billion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you found these examples of lost productivity on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
If you add all these up, are we doing anything at all?
Well, it accounts for about I think the first 100 hits on Google accounted for something like 10% of the gross domestic product. So you have to think that we would be a dynamic economy if only we didn't lose all this productivity. my favorite is hidden grief, you try and imagine the measurement problems in determining how much hidden grief is costing the economy, and you realize these are basically numbers that are created. I mean, what you do is you say, well, how many people do you think are affected? How much time are these people affected, and what's their time worth per hour? And you multiply, and you come up with some gigantic figure, ordinarily in the billions of dollars. And it sounds impressive. It sounds scientific. It really means nothing at all if you change your estimate for how many people are affected by hidden grief or how many hours they are disturbed by hidden grief or how much they make per hour, you'll get entirely new statistics. So it turns out that there's an industry. I didn't realize this, but when you start looking up hidden grief on the Internet, you discover that there are people who will lost productivity. There are people who will calculate lost productivity for the purpose of lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a lost productivity industry, which is, I assume, very productive.
Yeah, that gets back to our most recent caller. We've got another caller waiting to talk with us. Let's go to Charleston next. Line 4, good afternoon.
Hi. My question involves more of the research end. I just came from academia, I guess. I was a PhD student doing psychological research in stroke. And I was so disappointed in the management of statistics that I actually dropped the program. I just went into teaching. My question is, who is in charge or who oversees the rigor or the who oversees the use of statistics in a PhD style of program or in that type of academic setting? Because from what I recall, fishing for significance is a reality that honestly just throws all of science into this mistrust category. And I don't know how to get beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really interesting is that we have lots and lots of scandals around data. The discovery that the rating services were rating companies far more generously than they should have been in order to encourage investors. Something like Arthur Andersen's accounting being implicated in the collapse of Enron. You do get periodic revelations of scientific fraud and so on and so forth. Precisely because we do fetishize numbers and we assume that they must be facts, we can be scandalized by the news that people have faked the numbers or distorted them or whatever. And I think that it's also the case that when you place great emphasis on numbers, there are pressures on people to produce good numbers so that police departments find themselves pressed to lower the crime rate or at least to have better crime rate statistics. And it's certainly true that if you want to get published in most academic disciplines, it's hard to get published delivering a manuscript, however well the study may have been designed, that has non-significant results. So there is a kind of pressure, not just to produce numbers, but to produce the correct numbers, that distorts lots of our activities.
Does a caller want to follow up?
Yes, please. What then do you, where is the place or is there a place for the idea of near significance or marginal significance? Because it seems like a slippery slope. It's different for every discipline. And a lot of times it adds meaninglessness to those numbers that you've been talking about.
Yeah, and I think that what happens, of course, is we devise systems that are supposed to protect this. I mean, one of the reasons that you have an outside person on the dissertation committee is to try and make sure that the department isn't just allowing hanky panky to occur in the dissertations that it's approving. Publications have editorial processes with peer reviewers and so on and so forth that are supposed to do this. And we try and devise protections, but of course it's very difficult to get around, you know, the twin problems that deliberate fraud is often hard to protect, but also the pressure to deliver the appropriate numbers gives people an incentive to rig the game in a variety of ways. And this is, I think, a theme that runs through just about any activity. You see it, for example, the revelations about No Child Left Behind, when the test scores became very important. One of the surprising effects of No Child Left Behind was that schools started encouraging students that they didn't think could do well on the test to drop out. And, you know, you were going to produce better test scores by actually driving the students with the most severe problems out of the schools. And that may make better numbers, but it doesn't make for a solution to the educational problems that the policy was supposed to address.
I want to thank the listener for his call and take one more call this afternoon before we're out of time. Champagne, line one, hi.
Hi.
Hello? Hi.
Hello?
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 Are you there, Champagne?
Yeah.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Actually, on your previous thing about the cereal boxes, I would assume that it's a test. What they would do is see which appeal would be the best, you know, they'd get the strongest appeal from. They've done this with magazines. Sometimes you'll see two different covers on the thing, and then what happens, what they're trying to do to see what appeal, and that kind of thing. So that's my suggestion. So anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, that strikes me as plausible.
Okay. I think we've got one more call coming in on line two, Henry. Okay. Let's take this call just coming in. Line two, good afternoon. Line two?
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi. Wanted to say I really enjoyed Joel Best's talk, but I also have a critical question about food security. It's correct that the federal government measures food security and insecurity rather than hunger per se, but of course hunger and what that means is very political, and is, the measures are an outcome of that politics. So is it the case that when we say food insecurity, we are also including, say, people who went hungry last night, as well as people who don't know where their next meal is coming from or need to use a food bank, et cetera, so it doesn't preclude that, just so that we're specific when we debunk as well? That's my question. I'll take it up here.
Okay.
Thanks.
No, I think that's, you know, this is obviously an issue with absolutely every social movement, and you can see this, you know, how should we define homeless? What is homelessness? What is hunger or what is food insecurity? What is crime? You see it again and again and again. And serious, sincere people can have honest disagreements about that, and I don't think there's any problem with that. I think that it is important, however, that people be open about what they're talking about and make, you know, the actual issues clear. And I don't think that can always be done. And I particularly don't think it is often done by the media, which tends to favor the more dramatic claims.
One last thing that we can talk about here this afternoon, and then we're definitely out of time. One of the things that you say in this latest book is that we should be aware that, in general, the worse things are, the less common they are. Want to give us an example and tell us why that's important?
Sure. If you read a news story about child abuse, it will often begin with the story of a child who's beaten to death. You know, it's the worst possible example of the problem. And in fact, when you look at child abuse statistics, the most common category of abuse is actually neglect, which is you know, not a good thing, but it also isn't usually fatal. And I think that again and again and again, if you just look at the FBI crime statistics, murders are a whole lot less common than larcenies. And I think that this is almost a general law of social life. The more serious the problem, the less common it is.
Hmm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Joel Best, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much, Celeste.
Joel Best is professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Delaware. He is the author of 3 books on statistics for a general audience, Damned Lies and Statistics, More Damned Lies and Statistics, and most recently, Stat Spotting, a Field Guide to Identifying Dubious Data. All 3 books are published by the University of California Press.